Good morning. Let me just check that you can all hear again. Super. Thank you very much. Now, today I want to talk about Tycho Brahe, the first man, as I indicated to you yesterday, was the first man who was the first serious taker of data. He's a Dane, and was a Dane. The three Scandinavian countries, Denmark, Norway, and Sweden, had formed a confederation in the 14th century called the Kalmar League. But by the 15th century, and so the and certainly in the 16th century, the Danes had become dominant, and the Swedes didn't like that, and so there was a revolt and a war. There were many wars and many revolts, but a young man named Gustav Adolf Vasa in 1538 led a revolt of the Swedes against the Danes, and he is, of course, the Swedish national hero, but also in escaping from the Danes, he had to ski in the middle of winter a very long distance, and there has become an annual, I think it's February, skiing race in Sweden called the Vasaloppet, which is an incredible distance of 90 kilometers of cross-country skiing. That's, of course, over twice a marathon distance, and people do this now, the winner, in under 5 hours. It's quite a remarkable thing, and it has been going since 1922 and is one of the most famous things to happen in the country. Well, I'm not allowed to talk about sex and marijuana, so... despite the fact that Sweden became independent, the southernmost province, which was called Scania in Latin and Skåne in Sweden, remained part of the Danish kingdom. And it was there, and it remained part of Denmark, in fact, until 1658, but it was there on the 14th of December in 1546 that a young man was born to the Brahe family. His name was Tyge in Danish, and he's much more famously known by his Latinized name of Tycho. Now, he was born to his father and mother, of course, and they had a fair amount of money, but his uncle, Jürgen, was very wealthy and had made a deal with his brother. Since Jürgen had no children, he had made a deal with his brother that the uncle would get the firstborn child. God knows how that managed. I think he had more money than the father. And so after Tycho was born, he basically kidnapped him and raised him as his own son. He studied Latin at school and then was enrolled in the University of Copenhagen at 13 years old, where he was supposed to study rhetoric and philosophy. 13 was apparently not an unusual age to go to university at that time. But he noticed a partial eclipse of the sun in 1560. And not only did he notice it, but it had been predicted in advance, and he wrote, this was, and I quote, "as something divine that men could know the motions of the stars so accurately that they could long before foretell their places and relative positions." And this fascinated him and changed his life. He bought himself a copy of the ephemerides, which are just tables of the positions of objects in the sky, and that's what he studied. He also found a copy of Ptolemy and read that too. And he ignored his regular courses of philosophy and rhetoric. His uncle didn't like that. He was a nobleman. He was supposed to study what noblemen studied. And so he sent him off to Leipzig sent him off with a tutor named Anders Wedel. Thinking that this would distract him from astronomy. But they went to Leipzig, where he enrolled in university, and continued to study astronomy, despite the best efforts of Wedel, who eventually gave in and helped him with his studies, and the two men became fast friends for life. Here's a portrait of Brahe. which I like a lot because he's got this phenomenal mustache. But you can also see the thing that people know most about him, namely his metal nose, which is right up there. And we will talk about that because that's what everybody who knows about Brahe, if they know nothing else about him. He enrolled at the University of Leipzig in 1562. He was now 16 years old. Again, this is not unusual. And he had copies of as much astronomical data as he could get at the time. And he noticed that there were problems with these data, that is the predictions of, for example, a conjunction of the planets Jupiter and Saturn did not take place when it was predicted. And so he, at the early age of 16, had the idea that we needed to measure things better. He was the first person to really seriously understand that in any science that I know of, and therefore can be thought of in many cases as the father of experimental science. What he did is he bought himself a compass, and he would try to point the legs of the compass at two stars to measure the angular distance between them. It's not very accurate. So he bought himself a cross staff, which is a better instrument, although not great. And you can see it here. You move this stick back and forth along that stick until each end is in line with the star, and then you measure this angle between and so forth. And he began to record some of the objects that he had. Now, he returned to Denmark shortly thereafter because of yet another war breaking out between Denmark and Sweden. And during that war, the king of Denmark, his name was Frederick II, the kings of Denmark, if you don't know, are Frederick Christian, Frederick Christian, Frederick Christian, ad infinitum. King Frederick II, this one was on his horse and riding across a bridge over some river or moat or something, and he fell off, I think the horse shied, and he fell into the water. Uncle Jürgen, who was a big shot in the army, jumped in the water after him and rescued the king. This is in 1566. The king survived. Jürgen caught pneumonia and died. Anyway, the king was very grateful, obviously. In the following year, 1566, he returned to Germany to attend university at Wittenberg, which was a very famous Protestant university, and that befit, of course, the fact that that was the place where Luther nailed his 95 theses to the cathedral door, and also the place where Shakespeare put his hero Hamlet as a student from Denmark as well. The university was renowned for astrology and for alchemy, for mathematics and whatever medicine was in those days, and certainly not for for astronomy. He stayed for a little while at Wittgenstein and then went north to the University of Rostock, which is right on the it's in Germany, right on the Baltic Sea, and so a comfortable place for Scandinavian students, because it's right across the water from Denmark. And it was at Rostock that the most famous event that everybody knows about, namely his nose, took place. In December of 1566, so Brahe was 20 years old, he had an argument with a fellow Danish student there, one Manderup Parsbjerg. And they then met again at a party about 2 weeks later, and they had a really serious argument, and they decided to settle their argument, as was the wont in those days, with a duel. And this duel was fought on the 29th of November at 1566 at 7 p.m. Well, this is pretty far north, and at 7 p.m. in late December, it was pitch black. And so there are these two guys hacking at each other with swords in the dark. And nobody died, but it was settled when Parsberg's sword cut off a piece of Brahe's nose. And it didn't cut off the tip, which is what I originally thought. It cut off the bridge, as we've seen in that picture, this piece right here. Brahe obtained then a prosthesis, with, and he had a little thing of ointment that he carried around, and he pasted this metal prosthesis in, and we'll come back to that at the very end. It's not clear what the duel was about. Brahe's first biographer, Pierre Gassendi, in the 17th century, wrote that it was about who was the best mathematician, but most people think it was over a young woman, which sounds much more reasonable. During his stay in Rostock, Frederick, King Frederick, made him a gift of a sinecure, that is money, every year, from a church in Roskilde. Roskilde, for those of you who don't know, is a town just to the west of Copenhagen, and it's a very famous place. It has what's called the Grave Chapel. And Brahe was supposed to take care of that, was given a lot of money. The Grave Chapel is where the kings and queens of Denmark are buried and has the largest collection of dead monarchs in the world. And so this made him quite independent to fight, despite the fact that his father was still enrolled. Now, in 1569, he went back to the University of Basel and had made some observations along the way, both in Wittenberg and Augsburg. He had a very peripatetic existence, but then he was a very wealthy man. In Augsburg, he constructed his first serious astronomical instrument, and he's known for his ability to construct these things. This was an enormous quadrant, quarter of a circle, which he made for a nobleman who paid him for it. And here is a picture of a model of such a thing. The one he made was some 19 feet across, and it took 20 men who could barely carry it up a hill and mount it on the top of a hill. It was very, very big. It was made of wood, and it had on here a brass traversal to make accurate measurements. Here's a picture of what a traversal is. It's you make squares on the thing, and then you draw diagonals, and where this line then crosses, you can see it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, point 1, 2, 3, 4. And so you get very accurate measurements this way from the thing. Okay. He also arranged to have a globe made, a large globe, which was about, I have a picture of it later, about 5 feet in diameter. He had this made, and he was later to mark star positions on this globe. By 1570, now 24, Brahe was called back to Denmark by the illness of his father, who died shortly thereafter. And then Brahe not only had money from his uncle and money from the king, but he inherited the little estate his father had in Skåne in southern Sweden. And he then visited his maternal uncle, Jürgen being, of course, his paternal uncle. He visited his maternal uncle, with whom he had shared a great interest in alchemy, one of the things that was considered a very respectable thing to do in his day. Excuse me. He continued to write about the importance of making systematic observations. And a remarkable event occurred in 1572 when he was 26, and that caused him to spend the rest of his life doing exactly that. On the evening of the 11th of December, 1572, all these dates are in the Julian calendar, of course, he wrote that he was returning from his chemical laboratory when he looked up and he noticed an unusually bright star in the constellation Cassiopeia, a star which had not previously been there. I don't know if Cassiopeia is visible this far south, but it's a very prominent winter constellation in the northern hemisphere. I should have put a picture of it on. It's a W in the sky, and when I was a kid, I used to think that was put there for my sake. He said he could not believe his eyes because this thing had suddenly appeared, and he wasn't even sure it actually was real, so he asked all the people around and some peasant farmers, could they see it all also? And of course they could. He determined that he wanted to measure the position of that object, so he had a sextant built, a sextant being a sixth of a circle, like the quadrant. And this was quite large, it was about 4 feet long, so it was therefore fairly accurate. And he measured, that's about 6 feet long, that's right. He waited then for the next clear night, there aren't that many in southern Sweden in the wintertime, and then measured the position relative to the other stars in Cassiopeia. And what he noticed, that the position of this new star never changed relative to the other stars. What he's doing is he's measuring what's called parallax. It's well known in geometry that if you have a triangle, and if you know the base of the triangle, and you know an angle, you can determine everything about the triangle, including the length of its legs. And so if you measure the distance to the back of the room from here, and then I go over a certain fixed distance, and I measure this angle, then I can tell how far the back wall is. And that works fine, unless the two lines are parallel, because then the two lines meet at infinity, and you can't learn anything from that. And that's what he found. He found that there was no angle between the two lines, no parallax between the two lines. Therefore, this object was very far away. It did not depend on the time of day when the Earth had moved a little bit. It just didn't depend on anything. It was extremely far away. This new star was, of course, what we would call a supernova. And such things occur in the heavens from time to time. But of course, Brahe had no way whatsoever of knowing it. But what he said, what stunned him, was this thing had to be in the sphere of the stars. And the sphere of the stars was supposed to be perfect and immutable. And here suddenly was a new star. How could that possibly be? That was against everything that Aristotle or anybody else he had known he had ever read. So this changed everything for him. It was the most significant event, certainly scientifically, in his life. When he first saw it, the star was as bright as Venus. A month later, it was as bright as Jupiter. 8 months later, it had the same brightness as the other stars in Cassiopeia, and it changed color, he said slowly, from bright white to yellow and then to a dull red, rather like the star Aldebaran that we can see from here in the constellation of Orion. He wrote down these observations and he published these things in 1573, a year later, although he hesitated to do that because perhaps publishing a book was not within the something that a nobleman was supposed to do, but he did nonetheless. He wrote that it could not be attached to the spheres of the planets or it would move with them. And he calculates the parallax it would have if it were closer than the moon, and of course it doesn't, so it's farther than the moon. It can't be amongst the planets because it would move with the planetary spheres that he believed in, so it had to be on the spheres of the stars, this supposedly immutable place. A similar phenomenon had been noted and recorded by Hipparchus about 125 BCE, and that had also caused great consternation at the time. Brahe discusses in his book the possible astrological implications of such a new star, and such things were meant to predict great changes. But of course, 1572, was the time of the Counter-Reformation, the increasing strength of the Jesuits, and the St. Bartholomew's Day massacre had occurred that year. The Spanish were busily repressing the Dutch in the Netherlands, and the English feared a Catholic plot to assassinate Elizabeth, so it wasn't hard to say that lots of change was going on. The young Brahe ends this book with an extraordinary statement, which I have here. This is quoted in a book much later, but you can read that. He does not value such and calls nothing his but what has originated with himself. It's really quite a remarkable statement. Now, this new star was noticed by lots of people in Europe, and as with Brahe, it caused much speculation and consternation. People, of course, talked about the Star of Bethlehem and predicting the birth of Christ, so maybe it was thought to mark either the second coming or the end of time or something. And the fact that it had been seen from several different positions, always with the same angle, again meant that it was very far away. Brahe continued his observations both in Skåne and in Copenhagen throughout 1573 and 74. In addition, he started living with a young woman, apparently who was not of noble birth, Kirsten Jørgensdottir. Common law marriages between nobles and non-nobles was apparently quite common, but they lived together very well for 26 years and had numerous children. He began to be known for his observations, and he was encouraged to lecture at the University of Copenhagen in 1574 at the early age of 28. In early 75, he traveled to Germany, Switzerland, and Venice. He had a lot of money, he could afford to do that, without his family, and met lots of people interested in astronomy, astrology, alchemy. He returned to Skåne at the end of the year with the idea of moving to Basel, his favorite city in the world. But the King Frederick learned of this in February of 1576, and he knew already what a valuable person he was, had a debt of gratitude to the Brahe family who had saved his life, and also had a personal interest in astronomy. So he offered Brahe an island, the island of Wien, which is now part of Sweden rather than Denmark. It's called Wien, V-E-N, and it lies in the straits between Elsinore on one side and the Swedish city of Landskrona on the other side. And he was provided with a direct grant for money, as well as that church sinecure that he had, for the building of a castle there. He built a castle with an observatory, which he dedicated to the study of heavens. He called it Uraniborg, the castle dedicated to Urania, the muse of astronomy. And he started taking observations there on his 30th birthday, the 14th of December, 1576. These large pointed towers had removable panels so that observations could be made through them. Remember, there are no telescopes. And we'll see some of the instruments he built to put into these places. In the library that Brahe built in here, he had this great globe he had built and placed, and that he had that globe shipped up some 800 kilometers from a castle in Germany. Not surprisingly, it had developed some cracks and it was no longer perfectly round. So he made it round by covering it in wet parchment for 2 years, and then reshaping it, fixing the cracks, and then covering it with brass plates. And on these, he had an equator and a zodiac line. Here's a picture of his great globe. And on here, he inscribed all of his measurements over the next 20 years. Again, Gassendi, his 17th century biographer, said that this object cost at the time over £1,000, which must have been a huge fortune. It's certainly a massive device. One of his famous instruments is this mural quadrant. Here's a quarter of a circle on the wall. Okay, there you see the measuring rod. There he's pointing up at the hole in here through which observations were made. And he must have been very proud, because look what he had painted on the inside. There's he himself pointing up, and all these other things, pictures of his library and his workshops and so forth. And there is King Frederick, his patron. And there's a Latin inscription up here. Mural quadrant due to Tycho, but this inscription up here says, "Live wisely to arm yourself against death." He made many observations, and he felt the need for even more observations, even more instruments, so he built yet another underground observatory, because it's quite windy where he was. And he called this Tjärnegård, which means star castle. And all these things are underground. And each of these circles is over 6 meters in diameter. The Danish king must have been very fond both of astronomy and of Brahe, because he gave him direct money. He gave him that church sinecure in Roskilde. He gave him the farms and facility income from the island of Wien. And eventually he also gave him some farms and fiefs in southern Norway, the income from all of which was meant to support his work. But not all of his relations were very easy with the king, because he was very lax in his duties. He was supposed to, for instance, repair the grave chapel in Roskilde. He was supposed to maintain a lighthouse fire, in the straits between Denmark and Sweden. And he did almost none of these things, and occasionally the king would cut off his money until he complied, which he then, of course, rapidly did. He must not have been a very easy man himself to deal with. Still, he had a lot of money. And he lived on this island almost continuously from 1586 to 1597, those 13 years being the most productive and probably the happiest of his life. He was surrounded by family. As I said, he had numerous children, by students and co-workers. He made a printing press, which he had installed there. He hired a printer to use it. But again, he had a serious temper, and the farmers on his island did not like him, nor did some of his workers, with whom he had numerous arguments. He must have been a fairly hard taskmaster. But his fame spread widely, and he attracted numerous students. Two of them are particularly important in history. One was the German Paul Wittig, who came from the city then called Breslau, now the Polish city of Wrocław. One of the copies of Copernicus's book that Gingerich, I mentioned yesterday, investigated in his search, was supposedly annotated by Brahe himself, but was in fact annotated by Wittig. Wittig left because he had inherited some money back in Breslau, and on his way he stopped by Kassel, where the Landgrave of Kassel was very interested in astronomy, and helped him, knowing what he knew from Brahe, helped him improve his own sighting instruments. Brahe did not like that, because he was very jealous and he wanted credit for these things himself, and he thought that Wittig was stealing from ideas from him. But then Wittig died, so he gave that up. The other one, who was even more important, was a Dane named Christian Sørensen Longbader. Longbader means long mountain in Swedish, in Danish, and he's better known by the same surname in Latin, Longomontanus. He worked with Brahe on Wien from 1589 to 97, when they both left the island together and eventually getting to Prague, and we'll hear more about him later. There were lots of assistants, as I mentioned, and they were kept busy on the island with observations, with calculations, with building and repairing instruments, and working with Brahe in chemical laboratories. He spent much time on alchemy and on homeopathic medicine. He maintained correspondence with people throughout Europe, mostly in the Protestant countries, especially Germany, but also with lots of representatives of Queen Elizabeth's England. And I think it was James VI of Scotland, who then became James I of England after the death of Elizabeth, who visited them there. And certainly, because that James married Frederick's daughter, by the way. And Frederick certainly came there quite often. As a person hired by the king, he was required on occasion to cast horoscopes, which he did not like to do because he didn't believe an awful lot in that sort of thing. But he did a very famous one on the birth of the king's firstborn son, also of course named Christian, who was born in 1577. From his writing, well, never mind. King Frederick died in April of 1588, and this had serious consequences for Brahe's future. When Christian, the son, who was 11 when his father died, reached his majority. The year 1588 is very significant, of course, because it's the year of the Spanish Armada in English history. And it was also of great importance for Brahe, not only because his benefactor Frederick had died, but because he published a book containing some of his observations from Wien, and his picture of the cosmology of the universe, which was different both from that of Ptolemy and of Copernicus. And this was a step which has condemned him as a cosmographer, because he's wrong, but has ensured his eternal fame as the first great astronomical observer. And the fact that he insisted on a physically realizable picture of the universe is absolutely crucial and moves astronomy a lot closer to a modern science. In his system, oh, there's, by the way, the reconstructed, on this island now called Wien, the Swedes have reconstructed and made a museum, and here's a picture of it with Schoenebord reconstructed. But here's Brahe's system of the universe. Here's the orbit of the stars. They revolve around the Earth. All the planets revolve around the Sun, but the Sun and the Moon revolve around the Earth. Okay. Now, that's of great importance. This model, and I want you particularly to notice that here is the orbit of the planet Mars, and notice that the planet Mars intersects at some point the orbit of the Sun. This will turn out to be a very crucial point. There was a famous comet. He had demonstrated that the supernova of 1572 was extremely far away. Then there was a comet in 1577, which he had also found and measured the position of, and he had determined via parallax that this thing was farther than the moon, but not as far as the stars. And therefore, it had to have passed through the planetary orbits. Now, if the planets, again, were on crystal spheres, a la Aristotle, this was impossible. So this was yet another nail in ancient astronomy's death. Namely, first of all, a new star appeared in the immutable heavens, and then you could have an object which passed through these so-called crystalline spheres. And that's why he had no trouble in intersecting this crystalline sphere, so to speak, with the orbit of the Sun. The orbit of Saturn, by the way, here, notice how close that comes to the stars, which we know to be completely untrue. Now, in Tycho's defense with this incorrect system, he knew things that Copernicus did not know. Copernicus said that all the objects move in circles around the Sun. If they move in circles, they move at constant speed. Now, Brahe measured and knew that the planets moved at different speeds at different times of the year. He was that good an observer. And that doesn't work in the Copernican system. And it wasn't until Kepler showed that they moved, in fact, in circles some 20 or so years later. They moved not in circles, but rather in ellipses, and therefore the speed varies depending on where in the ellipse they are, that we understood really the, Brahe's measurements of this idea. Now, Brahe worries, of course. I mean, he's living in a Lutheran country, and Denmark, strongly Lutheran, so that even people who were Calvinist or believed in Zwingli had a serious difficulty, as Kepler was about to find out, let alone Catholicism, let alone believing in something like Copernicus, who was, after all, a Catholic canon. And so that may have influenced Brahe. We don't know about that. The era in which Brahe lived was well before there were any scientific journals, and people were, as they still are, extremely aware of priority issues and how important is their claim to their own discoveries. Even later, 100 years later, when there were journals, people still wrote down their ideas in code so that they could later on claim priority and the honor that went with that, and perhaps even some money. Now, it was in 1584, 4 years before this publication, that an extremely important thing happened in Brahe's life, and that probably influenced why he wrote this book in 1588. A Danish nobleman by the name of Erik Lange came to visit the island, to visit Brahe on the island of Hven, and he had with him a young surveyor named Nicholas Reimers, who later became known as by a Latin name of Ursus, or the bear, because he was a very irritable young man. He was born quite poor, he was Danish, born quite poor, and entirely self-educated. He had learned both mathematics and Latin just from borrowing books. He was also, by most accounts, a very quarrelsome and even what we might call paranoid young man, because he wrote and thought that Lange, his employer, was trying to murder him. So it wasn't long before Lange sacked him, and he wandered south to France and lived in Strasbourg for a while. And it was there in 1588 also that he published a book called The Foundation of Astronomy. And this book contained the same ideas as Brahe. It had the Earth at the center of the universe and the Sun revolving around it. It had two different things. First of all, rather than having the stars rotate, he had the Earth rotate. But also, in his model that he published, this orbit of Mars did not intersect the orbit of the Sun, and we will see how that becomes crucial. Now, he published this book, and he had no money, and he was looking to make money from the book. The book had 21 diagrams in it, and each of these diagrams was dedicated to a famous and wealthy person. He dedicated them, for example, to Gerard Mercator, who made the famous Mercator projection on flat paper of the spherical Earth. And I can remember as a kid at school wondering why the island of Greenland was so big, and that's because it's a Mercator projection. And also to Mercator's sons, there was a dedication to Professor Heinrich Brock at the University of Rostock. Now, Brock was the teacher, and the world was not a big place for these people, so intellectually, not physically. Now, Brock was the teacher of Brahe, and they had been friends, and so since Ursus sent him a copy of the book with Brahe's picture in it, or a modification of Braha's picture, Brock immediately wrote to Braha to inform him of this. Reimers traveled down to Kassel and had dedicated a picture to the Landgrave of Kassel, and his mathematician, Christian Rockmann, also knew Braha, also wrote him a letter, also complaining about this. In a letter to yet another informant, Braha quotes his story about Reimers, or as he calls him, the Dithmarschian, because he was born in the Danish town of Dithmarsch. When Lange had visited in 1584, Braha was having a discussion with Lange and some other noblemen who had visited, and Reimers was sent out of the room. And here is a quote from what Braha said at the time. "But that Dithmarschian sensed that something secret was being discussed, as he was somewhat nosy. For that reason, he investigated pretty carefully whether he could find something of this sort and take it away furtively. Thus, among my papers lying on a windowsill, he came across a certain sketch of the arrangement of the heavenly motions, which, however, through some negligence or other, was drawn in such a way that Mars' sphere completely enveloped the sun's. This, being incorrect, was discarded and set aside as unsuitable and out of line. Yet he grabbed it as the true and correct sketch. Later on, either he drew it secretly or he committed it to memory. Now, lying insolently, he advertises it as his own invention. He has pretended that he thought it out 3 years ago in a certain corner of the Kingdom of Poland, where undoubtedly he never was. Without any shame, he dedicates it to the most illustrious prince, the Landgrave, as though it were his own discovery." So Braha makes a big point about this intersection, which he claims and which Ursus does not have in his model. Nonetheless, it had some significance because the Holy Roman Empire Emperor at the time, Rudolf II, who was a very superstitious young man and deeply interested in astrology, hired Ursus as the imperial mathematician to cast horoscopes for him. Now, when Frederick died in 1588, his son, Prince Christian, was elected, and even though he was only 11, his mother, the queen, tried to take control of things, but noblemen pushed her out of the way, and they took over and said they would reign in power until Christian was 20 years old, which they did in that case. And he began to rule on his own in 1596 without the same love for either Braha or astronomy as his father. Braha was a man of considerable pride and arrogance, as we have seen, and he and the king quickly fell out. And so finally, after having an enormous number of arguments, the two of them, and with the king removing most of Braha's funds by 1597, Tycho left the island and moved back to Copenhagen. There he was forbidden from making any observations and forbidden from doing any alchemical experiments, and so in a huff he left and went to Germany. He went to Rostock and made numerous observations and so forth, and then but apparently he was regretted his decision to leave, and so wrote back to the king asking for permission to come back. The king told him quickly where to get off, and so he never went back to Denmark. He apparently was concerned because he had now over 700 stars marked on his globe, a real lifetime's work. Much of that had been done with what today we would call public money, and he was probably afraid that the king would seize his work, and one of the reasons why he probably left. Now, then the plague showed up in Rostock. He went to Hamburg, and he stayed there for a while. But he was looking for a more permanent home and a more permanent position, and he sent copies of his publications to various nobles, to landgraves, and to Emperor Rudolf. He was heading for Prague to visit the emperor and got as far as Dresden, but he learned that there was plague yet again in the capital, and the court had left, and so he stayed in Dresden. But by the spring of 1599, he arrived in Prague, and he remained there until his death 2 years later. By this time, the dispute with Ursus had reached great proportions. More importantly, some of Reymer's astrological predictions for the emperor had proved to be catastrophically incorrect. And unless you're very vague about making astrological predictions, as certainly Kepler was, you're bound to screw up once in a while. And he did. He had made some predictions about some famous Romanian who then died when he was supposed to be a great conqueror. And that caused Rudolf to lose faith in him. And at the same time, he knew Brahe was coming, and so he split and got out of Prague and moved. Emperor Rudolf, there's a picture of him, Holy Roman Emperor. I always love this. You know, the joke in history. It's neither an empire, nor is it holy, nor is it Roman. He was a terribly superstitious man. He was apparently not very involved with his kingdom, and his brother, I think it was, eventually overthrew him. But he then hired Brahe to replace Ursus as imperial mathematician. He also gave him a very famous, gave him a castle, which still exists. It's in Banatki. It's about 40 kilometers away from Prague. And this place, this is a real picture of the present time, so, it's still around. And it's, obviously a very nice home. Because Brahe was a very well-known and well-respected man, much more so than Ursus, he wrote letters to everybody he knew criticizing him. But Ursus was not known as the bear for nothing. And in 1597, before Brahe got there, he had published a book called On Astronomical Hypotheses. This book was so vitriolic, so full of invective and attacks on Brahe, that it could not pass the censorship that the Catholic Church applied to all books, and it could not be published by the emperor and at the emperor's expense. So Ursus had it published by some unknown publisher and at his own expense, because he by this time had a little bit of money. In this book, as a testament to his cleverness, he included a letter written by a young, relatively known, unknown young mathematician from the Austrian town of Graz, a certain Johannes Kepler. This letter, which Kepler sent in 1595, would turn out to cause him considerable trouble. J.L.E. Dreyer was a Dane who lived from 1852 to 1926, and I put on the reading list a book of his called The History of Astronomy from Thales to Kepler. But he lived in Northern Ireland and was the director of the Armagh Observatory. He knew, of course, Latin, and he certainly knew Danish because he was born in Denmark. And he wrote this book called Tycho Brahe, A Picture of the Scientific Life and Work in the 16th Century, and it's still the definitive biography of Brahe. And I would strongly recommend reading it if you really want to learn about the man, with one great caveat, because it's written at the end of the 19th century, and at the end of the 19th century, anybody reading a book like that had studied Latin at school, and so he includes lengthy Latin quotations without any translations. And so I had to sit with my dictionary and carefully and trying to remember all that horrific grammar from school days to understand what he was saying. So it takes a little bit of effort. He discusses at great length the controversy between Brahe and Ursus, and he concludes, and I quote, though it could not possibly be proved that Reimers had copied the idea of his planetary system from Tycho Brahe, it must be conceded that the latter had good reasons for suspecting him. Now, Dreyer never got to see this book on astronomical hypotheses, Ursus's wretched book, because most copies, it being an illegal publication, had been ordered burnt. But copies did exist, and in the 20th century, historian Edward Rosen, who lived in New York, and wrote a book called Three Imperial Mathematicians, that is, Reimers, Brahe, and then Kepler, has seen this wretched book. And what he does is he lists all of Brahe's arguments, and then he numbers his responses to them. And then at number 23, his response says, "Let it be a theft then, but it was intellectual. Learn to safeguard your possessions hereafter." That's pretty much a confession, I would think. Kepler had read this book, so it's likely that he noticed this as well, and he comments clearly on it in various letters. But he hadn't read it in 1595, of course, because it hadn't yet been published. So when he sent his own silly letter to Ursus, which we'll talk about tomorrow. By the end of 1599, then, Brahe was in Prague, and he invited Kepler to visit him and discuss their various interests. So Kepler left Graz in January of 1600, and he traveled to Brahe, staying about 4 months with him. Meanwhile, Brahe was busily collecting evidence, as much evidence as he could, against Ursus, and he was instituting legal proceedings against him for plagiarism. One of the things that got Ursus into trouble, of course, was this terrible mistake he made in predicting the glory of this Romanian prince who then died. But he was also reported that he had copied that horoscope from a Prussian astrologer, and that accusation of plagiarism helped Brahe, of course, with his accusations. He and Brahe did not get along very well at first, and even though Brahe wanted to hire him, Kepler was worried about that and concerned, and so he did not accept the offer originally, but went back to Graz in 1600. But then things changed dramatically for Kepler in August of 1600. Remember, he was a Protestant. Graz was in Austria and was a Catholic town. And in August of 1600, all Protestants were ordered to leave Graz or convert to Catholicism. They had to leave, they had to sell or abandon their property and be permanently exiled from the city. Well, if every Protestant had to sell their property, you can imagine the bottom fell out of the market. House prices collapsed, and Kepler lost most of his money. He was poor to begin with, and now he was poorer. Well, that made him change his mind, and he came back to Brahe to start work with him. Shortly thereafter, Brahe died, and I want to read you Kepler's words about his death. On the 13th of October, 1601, he was invited to supper at the house of the Baron of Rosenberg and went there in company with the imperial counselor, Ernfried Minkowitz. During supper, he was seized with illness, which was aggravated by his remaining at table. What he means is Brahe needed the toilet and wouldn't get up from his place after drinking a considerable amount of beer. On returning home, he suffered greatly for 5 days when he became somewhat relieved, although sleeplessness and fever continued to harass him. He was frequently delirious and at other times refused to keep the prescribed diet, but demanded to be given to eat anything he fancied. 5 more days elapsed in this manner. During the night before the 24th of October, he was frequently heard to exclaim that he hoped he should not appear to have lived in vain. When the morning came, the delirium had left him, but his strength was exhausted, and he felt the approach of death. His eldest son was absent, and his second daughter and her husband also, but he now charged his younger son and his pupils to continue their studies, and he begged Kepler to finish the Rudolphin tables as soon as possible. These were his continued predictions of where things were in the sky, dedicated to the Emperor Rudolph, and to replace the Alphonsine table. Adding the hope that Kepler would demonstrate the theory according to the Tychonic system and not by that of Copernicus, because Brahe knew that Kepler liked Copernicus. Shortly afterwards, he peacefully drew his last breath amidst the tearful prayers of his family and pupils. He had reached the age of 54 years and 10 months. On the 4th of November, 1601, Brahe was buried at the Tienkirche in Prague with great pomp in a semi-Protestant ceremony still permitted there. We don't know why Brahe died. He appears to have died of uremic poisoning. It was thought that he had kidney stones, although that's quite controversial. There have been several theories, suggestions made that since he had died suddenly and at a fairly young age, that he was poisoned. And it's also been suggested and proven that he had mercury in his system. And he did alchemical experiments, people experimented with mercury, that's quite possible. To my mind, one of the suggestions made that's really ridiculous is that Ursus poisoned him, but Ursus had died 14 months before Brahe, so not very likely that he was the culprit. But to my mind, the most insidious suggestion has been that Kepler murdered him for the data that he had. Now, this might be possible, but I really think it is unlikely in the extreme. The two men had difficulties, certainly, and both of them were very proud. But Kepler was a deeply, deeply religious man, a man who continually wrote that he worked for the glory of his God. The idea that he would stoop to murder seems to me extraordinarily unlikely. There was a book published in 2004, which suggests this, and I really believe that book was written not for scholarly purposes, but just to make money, and it makes me very upset. At the beginning of the 20th century, Brahe's remains were exhumed, and some mercury traces were found in the hair from his beard, which was still extant. No kidney stones were discovered in the coffin. After this scurrilous book of 2004, in November of 2011, yet another exhumation of this poor man's remains were made, and they have been, the result of that has been recently published, and it shows that indeed there was mercury in his system and far from enough to have killed him. So he was not poisoned as he was by mercury. There is no known cause for his death. It's likely, as I said, these alchemical experiments are where the mercury came from in his system. It was also discovered that on his skull, they looked at this place where the prosthesis had been, and they found traces of copper and zinc. Now, copper and zinc are what form brass when they are made together, and so probably his prosthesis was brass, although everybody up until that had thought that it was gold and silver. But I like to think that he had an everyday one of brass, but when he went out with fancy things, he put in the gold and silver prosthesis. And with that, I think I shall stop, but tomorrow we shall come, and the last discussion we will have will be of the incredibly important Johannes Kepler. Thank you very much.